morning. This is Hugh LaFotte, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with George Fletcher, Cardoza Professor of Jurisprudence at Columbia University, and we're going to be discussing his book, Our Secret Constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy. George, glad to have you on the show.
Hello, Hugh. Glad to be with you.
Your book is an attempt to argue that Abraham Lincoln, in some sense, gave us a new constitutional order. I wonder if you could briefly provide the listener with an overview of the argument in that book.
Sure, I'd be delighted to. We generally assume that we have had one constitutional tradition since 1789, when the Constitution, first Constitution, as I call it, became effective. In fact, we had a major rupture in our tradition in the course of the Civil War. And I would say that beginning in 1863 with the Gettysburg Address, we found ourselves committed to a different set of fundamental values. The three values that defined the first Constitution were the principle of being a republic, the notion of freedom, and the idea of the American people as a voluntary association. In the new Constitution, beginning with the Gettysburg Address, we find ourselves committed to three principles that are just the opposite. First of all, we are committed to the idea of a democracy instead of a republic. We are committed to the idea of equality over individual freedom. And we are also committed to the idea that we have a nation, an indissoluble organic nation, as opposed to a merely voluntary association of people and states.
You argue that there is this new constitutional order, and we want to elaborate on that in a moment. On the other hand, the subtitle of your book is Our Secret Constitution.
Yes.
And the implication is that although Lincoln began this new constitutional order, it did not come into effect immediately. I wonder again if you could give the listener a brief overview.
Yes, I think that the idea of it being a secret constitution is important because the ideas that I'm talking about are implicit in the post-bellum constitutional order, implicit in the new world, and based upon the principles of democracy, equality, and nationhood, the ideas that Lincoln advanced and established in our culture. But there was a tendency beginning around about 1880. To undermine these commitments, and the fact the Supreme Court ignored the revolutionary impact of the Gettysburg Address on the Civil War and returned to the original principles of the Constitution. But my claim is that these basic ideas of equality, nationhood, and democracy eventually found their way out into the open, not necessarily in the decisions by the courts, but in other ways, through the process of constitutional amendment, through the process of cultural change, through the way the law is taught in the universities. All of these ways have influenced a constitutional culture that has enabled our secret constitution to become more and more open and recognized as the binding constitutional order. So we live in a time in which the ideas of Lincoln are, as it were, coming out from under the camouflage of history.
Now, in your story, Lincoln plays an absolutely pivotal role, in particular the Gettysburg Address, which you call the preamble to this new Constitution. Can you briefly explain what it was about the Gettysburg Address that was so important and perhaps identify some of the central points that set the stage for this new constitutional order?
Yes, Hugh, I'd be happy to. The Gettysburg Address underscores the basic set of new ideas so that you find an emphasis on equality. We know that because Lincoln goes back to the Declaration of Independence when he says 47 years ago. He's not referring to the Constitution. If you do the arithmetic, you see that he's referring back to 1776 and the Declaration of Independence and the great phrase coined by Thomas Jefferson, all men are created equal. So we therefore find the emphasis on equality. The emphasis on nationhood is evident in the text of the Gettysburg Address as well. The term nation appears 5 times in the course of 268 words. It is the central theme. Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, a new nation. The emphasis was not on a new collection or a new voluntary association. The term nation became important, critical, in the discourse of the country, in the vocabulary by which Americans defined who they were. And then democracy is obviously critical in the parting and the closing phrase of the Gettysburg Address, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. So that the notion of the democratic equal nation takes the place of the republic based upon freedom and voluntary association. And this is a radical transformation that is equivalent to the enactment of a new constitution. Now, of course, Lincoln didn't intend the Gettysburg Address to have that significance, but that's the way it was received into history. It was received by subsequent generations as a definitional moment that recast the entire stage of history.
Okay, and in this new moment, constitutional moment, as you call it, began to get filled out with the Reconstruction Amendments. I wonder if you could briefly describe what those are and why those played such an important role.
Yes, well, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, they're called the Reconstruction Amendments, which were ratified between 1865 and 1870, provide some black-letter law, some basic rules to instantiate the new order that Lincoln had in mind. So, for example, and one of the major themes that comes out, for example, from the 13th Amendment, which prohibits slavery, is that the government must take an aggressive, active role in realizing these new goals of the constitutional order, so that the prohibition in the 13th Amendment is against slavery being allowed even among private individuals, and therefore the government must be vigilant. It must assert itself to make sure that equality is preserved. And then the 14th Amendment recognizes that the fundamental principle of equality under law. This is the first time that the word equal enters into the official language of the Constitution. So the 14th Amendment, recognizing equal protection under the law, is a critical plank in the new platform. And then the 15th Amendment is the beginning of a general recognition of a right to vote. The 15th Amendment is limited to prohibiting denials of the right to vote on the basis of race and previous condition of servitude. But nonetheless, it is the beginning, which then gets filled out later in the series of constitutional amendments that extend the franchise to women, to people under the age of 21, over the age of 18, residents of the District of Columbia. Eliminates another amendment, eliminates poll taxes and thus eliminates discrimination in the franchise. So we see the beginning of a movement to establish a popular democracy as the form of government. These are revolutionary changes.
So the Gettysburg Address is the preamble. These three actual amendments, the Reconstruction Amendments, were the beginnings of this new order as embodied in law. I want to go back and ask you one question, though. You talked about these three contrasts. Nationhood, equality, and democracy are part of this new order. Are the three other contrasts, the old contrast, for example, freedom, do they disappear, or are they simply changed in emphases?
Well, that's a good question, Hugh. I don't think anything ever changes definitively in the world of law. You see, it's not like the world of science, where one theory disappears and a new theory reappears. The old order never disappears. It stays in the recesses, in the shadows, and it continues to influence the way we think. So the old principles of we the people, the principles of freedom incorporated in the Bill of Rights, and the principles of the voluntary association and the republic, all of these ideas remain in force. And in fact, to some extent, there has been a reaction against the new constitutional order, particularly in the areas of free speech and freedom of religion, so that these basic freedoms that are recognized in the First Amendment have become the kind of reactive force against an excessive emphasis on equality and democracy. So we see what we see basically is a tension between the new set of values and the old ones. And many people would like to think that the Constitution is simply a consistent set of rules, a kind of set of a game book, so a set of rules by which we play the game of government. But it's not like that. The Constitution has built into it contradictions and tensions, and many of the decisions that we see in practice are a way of acting out these ongoing conflicts that are in the Constitution itself.
All right. Would the continuing existence of these old ideas, particularly the notion of the republic and of freedom and so on, would they partly explain the suppression of what you call the new constitutional order, the fact that new constitutional order was driven underground?
Yes. Well, actually, it was driven underground, interestingly enough, even before the First Amendment began to assert itself on the national stage, so that the critical reaction by the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, was in the 1880s. And the major instrument by which the Supreme Court frustrated the new constitutional order was through the doctrine of state action, so that the new ideas were limited to restrictions on the states rather than on non-state organizations, so that therefore it became permissible for private social arrangements to discriminate against blacks, for example, and this wasn't subject to constitutional control. This is still an ongoing problem, but the notion of state action was a critical wave to subvert the new constitutional order. Also, in a very famous decision in 1883 in the civil rights cases, this court declared the first civil rights statute unconstitutional, and that was based upon the idea that Congress had exceeded its legislative limits in enacting the first civil rights bill. We eventually found ways to allow the emergence of this anti-discriminatory legislation, but not through the old ways. We had to, in the 1960s, we had to develop this idea of an expanded notion of interstate commerce and then conclude that the Civil Rights Act, for example, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, was based upon the regulation of interstate commerce. So eventually the lawyers and the courts found a way around the decisions of the 1880s, but it took some time. And it took some time, therefore, for Lincoln's ideas and Lincoln's vision of a new American Constitution finally to take hold. Now, what many people regard as the very aggressive jurisprudence in the field of First Amendment and free speech and freedom of religion, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that actually begins midway into the 20th century. And it's only then that we see a kind of ongoing awareness that someone has to stand up for these old values that are quickly being displaced. So therefore, basic freedoms become a new rallying cry, a new form of opposition against the ideas of equality and democracy. And therefore, when democracy became too strong, the idea was, well, the courts therefore have to protect individual rights against what was called the tyranny of the majority. The fear of too much democracy led to increasing judicial intervention on the behalf of individual rights.
I want to elaborate on some of those themes in the second half of the show, but pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who's tuning in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is George Fletcher, Cardoza Professor of Jurisprudence at Columbia University, and we're discussing his book, Our Secret Constitution, How Lincoln Redefined American Democracy. You talk about, the pressures that drove the new constitutional order underground. And in your book, you spend some time discussing a couple of key cases. You talked about the Slaughterhouse cases, and you talked about Lochner, both of which seem to play an important role. And they also exhibit the pressures that you were talking about a moment ago, the idea that the states ought to maintain power, and the emphasis on freedom, in particular economic freedom. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit more on both of those.
Yes, both of these cases stand for one of the great ironies of history, in my opinion, and it's the irony that's captured in the phrase that the South finally gained power at Appomattox. I mean, everything is ever quite what it seems. And the basic principles that were asserted in the Civil War seem, for at least a period of time, to come out to be just the opposite of what the war should have decided. The war should have clearly decided that the notion of a central government had displaced individual state autonomy, and yet the arguments for individual state autonomy after the Civil War seemed to become even stronger. It's as though the war was being fought by different means. Now it was being fought out in the courts. And in the courts, the South began to win. And it began to win in the 1880s. It's like, they lost the war on the battlefield, but they still had the law. And the law turned out to be a much more powerful weapon than the battlefield, because it was in the law that they were able to assert and maintain a conception of American government that was based upon individual state autonomy. That's the idea that comes through in the slaughterhouse cases. That's the idea that comes through in the civil rights cases. That's the idea that begins to dominate American thinking in the latter half of the 19th century. And, you know, it's particularly paradoxical because at the time of the Civil War, there were 37 states. There were 13 states that were added after that. But even then, if you think about it, all the states that were added, except for Texas, which was an autonomous republic, all the states that came in after the original 13 came in as new versions of federal territories. They had originally been federal territories, then they became states. They were never autonomous entities. They were never individual states like Virginia, right, or Maryland, and therefore they could claim some kind of state's rights. And yet they got these new states, got the benefit of the ideas that we attributed to the original 13. They were treated as though they were once autonomous republics. This is quite an amazing idea. And it is, in a peculiar way, a vindication or a temporary vindication of the ideas that the South tried to fight for on the battlefield. They lost on the battlefield, but they won for a long period of time in the courts.
Okay. I want to focus for a bit on what seems to be, as I read your book, a really important notion, this notion of equality. I wonder if you could say a bit more about exactly what you mean by equality.
Yes, actually, it's one of my favorite subjects, so I'm glad you raised the theme. My own view is that the Declaration of Independence and the statement, all men are created equal, is one of the great moral insights of the 18th century and indeed of all of history. It's clearly an idea that is based upon a religious foundation. I don't think it's possible to talk about equality without talking about equality granted by a creator, and therefore the phrase all men are created equal is a clear reference to there being a creator. And in the document of the 1776 goes on to say that we are all granted inalienable rights and granted by our creator inalienable rights in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So that the religious dimension is very clear. The religious dimension establishes the basic idea that all human beings are created in the image of God. And that idea supported the abolitionist movement. It was only because people believed that blacks and whites were created in the same image of the same divine power that they could fight for emancipation, that the North could fight for emancipation. So the religious idea leads us to think of all men are being created equal. Once we really accept the truth of that basic proposition, then the next idea is, well, therefore, all people are entitled to equal treatment under the law. That is the major victory of the 14th Amendment. Now, of course, there are always problems in figuring out what equality means in practice. And one of the issues I deal with in the book is the extent to which we breach our notions of equality in certain areas. For example, we have yet to become very sensitive in the United States to the problem of an unequal wealth distribution, and particularly the way in which state educational systems further unequal wealth opportunities. I'm thinking particularly of a decision in Texas, the Rodriguez case, that held that it was permissible for the state of Texas to fund white schools substantially more than it funded schools attended by Mexican Americans. This is a serious problem of wealth inequality that we have failed to address. So the problem of equality and realizing equality under a law is an ongoing struggle. This is for sure.
Two major things I'd like to look at in the last third of this show. One is to talk about the ways in which the new constitutional order began to reassert itself. How did that happen? And perhaps you can pick out some of the most important points in that reassertion.
Yes, I think that the process of constitutional amendment was the critical means by which the Constitution, let's say, reformed itself and became a democracy. So constitutional amendment was a very important movement. Another critical movement was the assertion of the government as the responsible agent. And paradoxically, one of the areas in which that became noticeable was in the area of prohibition, because there's a peculiar similarity between the abolition of slavery and the abolition of the consumption of alcoholic beverages during prohibition. And the analogy is that these were the only two cases in our constitutional history in which the government took an affirmative responsibility to prevent something from happening. It had to prevent slavery from happening, and it had to prevent the sale and the consumption of alcoholic beverages. So we see a gradual movement into the 20th century of a more aggressive and responsible government that is going to ensure equality and the welfare of the citizens. And of course, in the New Deal, we see that government coming into full force. Take, for example, the recognition of the income tax. The Civil War established the first income tax because war requires money, and they had to raise money for the war. But then there was a period of time in which the courts regarded the income tax as unconstitutional, and it wasn't until much later that into the 20th century that a new constitutional amendment established the legitimacy of the income tax. So now we have a government asserting itself to bring about equality. So we get democracy largely through the process of constitutional amendment. We get equality through a more assertive government, backed up by the courts eventually, backed up by the courts beginning in the 1960s and the 1970s. The courts take an aggressive role in promoting equality. And we acquire a new sense of nationhood. I would say the new sense of nationhood is fueled largely, in large part, by a mass movement that began in 1892. That's the movement of the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, we've had a lot of controversy about that, but there was there's a strong sense from 1892 to the present that inculcating a sense of patriotic commitment to the United States is fundamental to our health as a culture. And certainly we see this even more strongly in attitudes that have developed since September 11th of last year. So that the notion of nationhood, patriotism, commitment to the and loyalty to the nation, these are ideas that are actually much, much stronger even than at the time that I wrote the book a year ago.
All right, in the last 4 minutes, I want to focus on what seems to me to be a really interesting part of your book, and you've certainly hinted at it several times, that the new constitutional order made the government more aggressive. In fact, you talk about, again, these two models. One is that government can only be a hindrance to freedom, and so you always have to be on the lookout for government. And the second model is that, no, government's not just a hindrance. It can actually promote valuable things, in particular, equality. What if you could explain that a bit for the listener?
Well, this idea that government should be promoting basic values is more ideas that you would find in European social democracy. The rhetoric of the United States is typically that we're afraid of government, that we don't want government to intervene. But in fact, we see a government that, despite it all, is becoming more and more aggressive, and particularly in the areas of equality. Take something like the census, for example. Now, I personally think the census goes too far. I think asking questions about racial origins, religious origins, some of the questions that are posed in the census, invade our privacy, that they, and not only do they, the problem of privacy, but would you trust, let's say, the government, the German government in 1938, to ask questions about, tell us about the racial background and the religious background of people living in this house? No, we wouldn't trust any government to ask questions like that unless we really believed in the virtue of government. And in fact, when it comes to bringing about equality among the diverse groups in the United States, we do seem to trust the government. And that is a critical aspect of this new constitutional order. The government must take responsibility for the realization of these fundamental values. And yet, we're very effective in camouflaging this assertion by government by maintaining the typical rhetoric from the past, namely, we're afraid of government, we don't want them to do it. All the time that we're saying things like that, of course, the government is constantly growing, the income tax is getting stronger, the census is becoming more intrusive, affirmative action becomes more deeply entrenched. We see a government that is more and more active, but the rhetoric of fear remains in place and therefore enables the government to act more effectively.
And I take it from your book that it's not just that you're reporting that the government has become more active, that although you recognize that there are dangers with the government being more active, that it's absolutely essential for achieving...
I actually do think it's essential, but therefore I also endorse a position that I think is a typically American position, namely that we need a vigorous commitment to freedom of speech and the freedom of the press in order to check the dangers of government. And you can see the rise of these two as somehow symbiotic. The more stronger government gets, the more faith we have to put in alternative institutions to protect ourselves from the dangers of big government. Therefore, an open and vigorous press becomes absolutely essential in our modern democracy. We're very reluctant to restrain freedom of speech and freedom of the press because we know that that is dangerous in terms of allowing government to have too much influence and too much play. So the rise of government encourages institutions that check its potential power. Certainly democracy is one of them. And courts are another important institution to protect individual rights. And freedom of the press is another fundamental institution that we need to counteract a constantly growing government.
And that's part of the recognition of the tension you talked about earlier, that
yes,
in order
indeed.
For the constitutional order to survive the new one, it has to recognize that there are elements of the old constitutional order that are absolutely essential.
Right, absolutely.
Okay. 30 seconds. Do you have a quick sum up for the listener of what you would like them to think about?
Well, I think the most important thing for an American reader is to realize that the legal system and the Constitution are not simply well-established rules by which we live, but they are constantly growing, conflicting principles that are in tension with each other. And the way to understand what goes on in politics and in the courts is to see the drama of this conflict and to appreciate the values that come from both sides. So that I have tried to develop an appreciation for the new constitutional order at the same time that I recognize that the old values from 1789 persist and continue to influence us. In fact, we need them as well as we need our commitment to democracy, equality, and nationhood.
Okay. Thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking today with George Fletcher, Cardoza Professor of Jurisprudence at Columbia University. This is Eula Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.